the enthusiasm, which quickly wanes when he turns my way again and adds, "Avery here was just leaving."
Chapter 12. Rill. It's 2 weeks before I learn that the kids here are wards of the Tennessee Children's Home Society. I don't know what wards means when I first hear Mrs. Murphy say it on the telephone. I can't ask either, since I'm not supposed to be listening in. I figured out that if I shinny up under the azalea bushes alongside of the house, I can get close enough to hear through the screens on her office windows. "Certainly all of the children are wards of the Tennessee Children's Home Society, Dorotha. I do understand your daughter-in-law's predicament. When unhappy, many men turn to liquoring and dalliances. It is so difficult for a wife. Adding a child to the home at long last might well brighten up the atmosphere and solve the entire problem. Fatherhood has a way of changing a man. I'm certain it won't be a problem, as you'll have no trouble paying the fees. Yes, yes, quickly, of course. A surprise for their anniversary. How sweet. If I could just give you one of these, Dorotha, I certainly would. I have some darling little cherubs just now, but Miss Tan controls all of the decisions. I'm only paid to board the children, and..." I figure it out from the conversation quick enough. That new word. Wards means that these kids' parents didn't come back for them. The kids here say that if your parents don't come get you, Miss Tan gives you to somebody else, and they take you home. Sometimes those people keep you, and sometimes they don't. I'm scared to ask too many questions, because we're not supposed to talk about it. But I've got a feeling that's why Stevie's big sister hasn't turned up again since the day we got here. Miss Tan gave her to somebody. Sherry was a ward. We're lucky we're not. We belong to Briny, and he'll fetch us soon as Queenie gets well. It's taken longer than I thought, and that's why I've started listening under Mrs. Murphy's window. I've been hoping to hear something about Briny. When I ask the workers, they just tell me to behave myself, or else we'll have to stay here longer. I can't think of anything much worse than that. So I do my best to see that all of us behave. I'm taking a chance coming up under the window like this, and I know it. We're not allowed to get anywhere near Mrs. Murphy's flower beds. If she knew I was listening to her phone calls and talks on the front porch when folks come by, I've got a few ideas about what might happen to me. She comes to the screen, and through the azalea leaves I see cigarette smoke puff out. It hangs in the wet air like the genie floating over Aladdin's lamp, and my nose tickles with a sneeze. I slap my hand over my face, and the branches move. A hammer pounds against my ribs from the inside. "Mrs. Pulnick," she yells. "Mrs. Pulnick!" My skin goes cold. "Don't run. Don't run," I tell myself. Fast steps come up the hallway inside.
"What is it, Mrs. Murphy?"
"Instruct Riggs to put out poison this evening under the azaleas. Those infernal rabbits have gotten into my flower beds again."
"I will be putting him to the task immediately."
"And have him tidy up the front yard and pull the weeds. Tell him to make use of the older boys in any way he sees fit. Miss Tan will be coming tomorrow. I'll have the place presentable or else."
"Yes, Mrs. Murphy."
"What's become of the ones in the sick room? The toddler boy with the deep violet eyes in particular. Miss Tan wants to see him. She has promised him for an order in New York."
"He is lethargic, I am afraid to say. As well, he is thin. He takes little bit of corn mush. I do not believe he will travel well."
"Miss Tan will not be pleased. I am not pleased. You'd think that having been raised in back alleys and ditches, the little gutter snaps would be hardier."
"That is true, yes. The girl in the sick room is declining as well. For 2 days, she refuses to eat. The doctor should be summoned, yes?"
No, of course not. Why in heaven's name would I have the doctor called over a bit of the runs? Children always have the runs. Give her some ginger root. That should do it.
As you wish.
How is little Stevie coming along? He is roughly the size of the boy in the sick room. Older, but that can be changed. What color are his eyes?
Brown, but he has become stubborn in wetting the bed as well. And he will not speak even a word. I do not believe a client would be content with him.
That will not do. Secure him to the bed and leave him in it for the day if he wets again. A blister or two will teach the lesson. In any case, brown eyes won't satisfy for this order. Blue, green, or violet. Those have specifically been requested. Not brown.
Robbie?
My throat catches. Robbie is the name they call my little brother. There's not another Robbie in the house. I'm afraid not. The five are being saved for a special viewing event. I swallow the burning in my throat, push it all the way down to my stomach. A special viewing event. I think I know what that means. I've seen parents come here a few times. They wait on the porch, and the workers bring their kids to them, clean and dressed, and with their hair all combed. The parents carry presents and give hugs and cry when they have to go. That must be what a viewing event is. Bryony's coming to see us soon. But that worries me, too. Last week, a man showed up to visit his little boy, and Mrs. Murphy told him the boy wasn't here. He's been placed for adoption, I'm very sorry. That was what she said. He's got to be here, the man argued. Lonnie Kemp, he's mine. I didn't sign him over for adopting. The children's home is just boarding him till I get back on my feet. Mrs. Murphy didn't seem worried, even when the man broke down and cried. Nonetheless, he is gone. The family court deemed it best. He has been taken in by parents who can provide very well for him.
But he's my son.
You mustn't be selfish, Mr. Kemp. What's done is done. Think of the child. He will be given what you could never provide for him.
He's my son.
The man fell down on his knees and sobbed right there on the porch. Mrs. Murphy just went back inside and shut the door. After a while, Mr. Riggs hauled the man up and walked him to the street and put him in his truck. He sat there all day watching toward the yard, looking for his boy. I'm worried that Bryony might come here and have the same problem. Only Bryony won't stand there and cry. He'll bust his way in, and something terrible will happen. Mr. Riggs is a big man. Miss Tan knows the police. Take the utmost care of the little one in the sick room, Mrs. Murphy says now. Give him a nice hot bath and some ice cream, maybe a ginger snap. Pep him up a bit. I'll ask Miss Tan if she might delay the order a day or two. I want him well enough to travel. Do you understand?
Yes, Mrs. Murphy.
Mrs. Polnick's words hiss through clenched teeth, which tells me I sure don't want to get caught here under the azalea bushes today. When she's in that mood, you better run fast and hide good, because she's looking for somebody to take it out on. The last thing I hear is Mrs. Murphy crossing the room and yelling into the hall. And don't forget about poisoning those rabbits! I grab up a broken branch and quietly start stirring the leaves over my knee prints, so Mr. Riggs won't be able to see that I've been here. I wouldn't want him to tell Mrs. Polnick. But that's not what scares me most. What scares me most is Mr. Riggs knowing someone's been going up under here at all. To make it to the azalea bushes, you've got to slip past the cellar doors. Riggs keeps them open, and if he can, he'll get kids in there with him one way or another. Nobody talks about what goes on down there. Even the big boys. If you talk about it, they say,
Riggs will get you and snap your neck and say you fell out of a tree or tripped on the porch steps. Then they'll cart your body off to the swamps and feed it to the gators. And nobody will ever hear about you again. James, the big red-headed boy, has been here long enough. He's seen it happen. We give him peppermints, and he tells us what we need to know to get by here at Mrs. Murphy's place. We're not friends, but candies will buy you a lot around here. Every morning when we wake up, there's a little wad of peppermint shoved under the door of our room. At night, I hear Mr. Riggs come around. He tries the knob, but it's locked. And the workers always take the keys when they put us in bed. I'm glad. Sometimes after Mr. Riggs comes by our room, I hear him walking up the stairs to the house. I don't know where he goes, but I'm glad we're down in the cellar. It's cold and the army cots are scratchy and smelly, and we have to use a slop pot at night. But at least nobody can get at us when we're in there. I hope Briony comes before enough beds empty out to move us upstairs. Riggs is just headed in the cellar door when I get to the end of the azalea hedge. I almost don't see him quick enough to let the branches fall back and hide me. He looks right at me before he walks down the steps. But he can't see me. I'm like the invisible man again. The invisible girl. That's who I am. I wait until I'm sure he's gone, and then I creep out of my spot, quiet as a little bobcat. The thing about bobcats is, they can be 2 foot from you and you'll never know it. One big breath, and I run past the cellar door and around the fig tree. After you're past it, you're safe. Riggs knows the workers look out the kitchen windows a lot. He won't do things where anybody else can see. Camellia's waiting for me on the hill behind the church house playground. Lark and Fern are riding a teeter-totter with Gabian in the middle. Stevie's sitting in the dirt beside Camellia. He climbs over into my lap soon as I sit down. Good, Camellia says. Get him off of me. He stinks like pee.
He can't help it.
Stevie wraps his arms around my neck and lays against my chest. He's sticky and he does smell bad. I rub a hand over his head, and he whimpers and pulls away. There's a goose egg under his hair. The helpers here like to thump kids on the head where it won't show. Yes, he can help it. He could talk, too, if he wanted to. He's just getting himself in trouble with the workers. I told him he better stop it or else. Camellia's a fine one to talk. If any of us does get the closet while we're here, it'll be her. I still don't know for sure what happens in the closet, but it must be bad. Just a couple days ago, Mrs. Murphy stood over the breakfast table and said, "When the food thief is caught, it'll be the closet, and not just for one day." Nothing's disappeared from the kitchen since. Stevie's just scared. He misses... I stop without saying it. It'll only make him upset if I bring up his sister. Sometimes I forget that. Even though he won't talk anymore, he can still understand everything we say. "What'd you hear at the window?" Camellia hates it that I won't let anybody else go under the azaleas. She always looks me over and sniffs at me to see if I found any peppermints while I was there. She thinks the big boys are lying about Mr. Riggs. If I don't watch her, she'll try to sidle off over there while we're out to play. I can't turn my back on her for a minute, unless I'm leaving her with the babies to watch. She didn't say anything about Briony. I'm still trying to make sense of what I heard under Mrs. Murphy's window. I'm not sure how much of it I should tell Camellia. "He ain't coming. He's got himself in jail or something, and he can't get out. Queenie's dead." I scramble to my feet, taking Stevie with me. "No, she ain't. Don't you say that, Amelia. Don't you ever say that." On the playground, the teeter-totters stop, and feet scrape the ground to hold swing still. Kids look our way. They're used to watching the big boys get in fights and roll around and kick and punch.
It don't usually happen with girls.
It's true.
Camellia's on her feet, quick as a whip, her chin poking out, her long skinny arms cocked on her hips. Wads of freckles seem to squint her eyes down to practically nothing, and her nose scrunches up. She looks like a spotted pig.
It ain't. Is so.
Stevie whines and squirms to get away. I figure I'd better let him. He runs off to the teeter-totter, where Lark grabs him up in her arms. Camellia rears back a fist. It won't be the first time we've gotten in a knockdown, spit-flying, hair-pulling match.
Hey! Hey, you cut that out!
Before I even see it coming, James is out of the big boy's hidey hole, and he's headed our way. Camellia hesitates just long enough for him to get to her. His big hand snakes out and grabs her dress, and he slings her into the dirt hard.
Stay down,
he growls and points a finger. She doesn't, of course. She pops to her feet madder than a swatted hornet. He shoves her down again.
Hey, I yell. Stop it!
She's my sister, even if she was about to punch my lights out. James looks my way and grins, the chipped tooth showing the pink tip of his tongue.
You want me to?
Camellia takes a swing at him, and he grabs her arm, holding her far enough away that she can't kick him. She's like a daddy long-legs spider with one foot stuck in a door. He squeezes so hard her skin goes purple. Her eyes fill up and spill over, but she just keeps on fighting.
Stop!
I yell.
Let her alone.
You want me to, then you be my girlfriend, pretty girl, he says. And? Elsewise, she's fair game.
Camellia roars and squeals and goes wild.
Let her be!
I take a swing, and James grabs my wrist, and now he's got us both, my bones crushed together. The babies run over from the playground. Even Stevie. And start pounding James's legs. He swings Camellia around and uses her to knock down Fern and Gabian. Fern's nose spouts blood, and she screams, grabbing her face.
All right, all right,
I say. What else can I do? I look around for grown-ups, and like always, there aren't any.
All right, what, pretty girl? James asks.
All right, I'll be your girlfriend, but I ain't gonna kiss you.
That seems good enough for him. He dumps Camellia in the dirt and tells her she better stay there. He makes me follow him up the hill and drags me around an old outhouse that's nailed shut so nobody can get in it and get snake bit. For the second time that day, a hammer pounds inside me.
I ain't kissing you,
I tell him again.
Shut up, he says.
Behind the outhouse, he pushes me to the dirt and plops down next to me, still squeezing my arm. My breath comes fast and hangs in my throat. I taste my stomach. What's he planned to do to me? Growing up on a boat and with four babies born after I came along, I know a little bit about what men and women do together. I don't want somebody to do that to me. Ever. I don't like boys, and I never will. James's breath smells like rotten potatoes, and the only boy I've ever thought I might let kiss me was Silas, and that was only for a minute or two. The chants of his gang wind their way around the building.
James has got a girlfriend, James has got a girlfriend, James and May sitting in a tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G.
But James doesn't try to kiss me. He just sits there with red splotches working up his neck and over his cheeks.
You're pretty.
His voice squeaks like a baby pig's. It's funny, but I don't laugh. I'm too scared.
No, I ain't.
You're real pretty.
He lets go of my wrist and tries to hold my hand. I pull it away and wrap my arms around my knees, holding myself in a tight ball.
I don't like boys. I tell him. I'm gonna marry you someday.
I don't want to marry anybody. I'm gonna build a boat and go down the river. Take care of myself.
I might get on your boat, too.
No, you ain't. We sit there a while. The boys down the hill chant. James has got a girlfriend. K-I-S-S-I-N-G.
He lolls his elbows over his knees, looking at me.
That where you come from? The river?
Yep, it is.
We talk about boats. James is from a dirt farm in Shelby County. Miss Tan picked him and his brother up off the side of the road when they were walking to school one day. He was in the fourth grade then. He's been here ever since, and not seen a day of school this whole time. His brother is long gone. Adopted. James lifts his chin. I don't want me some new parents, he says. I figure I'll be too big pretty soon and I'll get out of here. I'm gonna need me a wife. We can go live on the river if you want.
My daddy's coming back to get us.
I feel bad saying it. I feel sorry for James. He seems lonesome more than anything. Lonesome and sad.
He'll be here pretty soon.
James just shrugs. I'll bring you some tea cakes tomorrow, but you gotta still be my girlfriend. I don't answer. My mouth waters thinking about tea cakes. I guess now I know who's been sneaking around in the kitchen at night.
You hadn't oughta. You might get the closet.
I ain't scared. He puts his hand over mine. I let it stay there. Maybe I don't mind it too much. Pretty soon, I figure out it's not so bad being James's girlfriend after all. He ain't hard to talk to, and he only wants to hold my hand. Nobody bothers me the rest of the day. Nobody's mean to Camellia, or Lark, or the babies. James and I walk around the yard and hold hands, and he tells me more things I need to know about Mrs. Murphy's house. He promises me tea cakes again. He describes just how he'll sneak down and get them tonight. I tell him I don't like tea cakes. In the bath line, the big boys don't look at me. They know they better not. But the next day, James isn't at breakfast. Mrs. Pulnick stands over the table, tapping a wood spoon in her big, meaty hand. She says they sent James off to a place where the boys have to earn their keep, instead of getting it by the kindness of the Tennessee Children's Home Society. A boy who is old enough to pursue after the girls is old enough for work, and too old to be wanted by a good family. Mrs. Murphy will be having none of this behavior between boys and girls here. Each of you knows of our rules. She slaps the spoon hard against the table, her breath coming in heavy snorts that make her wide, flat nose flare out. We jerk upright like puppets with strings bolted to our heads. She leans toward the boys' side of the table. They duck and stare at their empty bowls. And for the girls? The spoon and the jiggly arm come our way now. So much shame to you for causing trouble to the boys. Mind yourselves. Keep down your skirts and behave as little women should. The last word comes with a hard look at me. Or I do not want to think of what may happen to you. Blood rushes hot up my neck and burns in my cheeks. I feel bad for getting James sent away. I shouldn't have been his girlfriend. I didn't know. The workers don't bring Stevie down for breakfast either. He's not on the playground. The other kids tell me he has to stay in his bed because he wetted again last night. I see him in the upstairs window later, with his nose pushed against the screen. I stand in the yard and whisper up at him,
Be good, all right? Just be good, that's all.
Later on that afternoon, the workers line us up on the porch, and I gather my sisters and my brother close because I'm scared. Even the other kids don't seem to know what's happening. Mrs. Pulnick and the workers march us by the rain barrel one by one. They swipe dirty faces and arms and knees with wet cloths and brush hair and have us wash our hands. Some kids are made to change their clothes right there on the porch. Some kids get fresh clothes or pinafores to put right on top of their play clothes. Mrs. Murphy comes outside and stands on the top step and looks us over. A wire rug beater dangles off her arm. I've never seen the kitchen women use it to knock the dirt out of the rugs, but I've seen it used on kids a lot. The kids call it the wire witch.
Something very special will be happening today, Mrs. Murphy says. But it's only for good little boys and girls. Anyone who isn't on best behavior will not be allowed to participate. Do you understand?
Yes, ma'am.
I say it right along with the rest of the kids.
Very well, she smiles.
But the smile makes me back up a step.
Today the bookmobile will be coming. The kind ladies of the Aid Society will be giving of their time to help you select books. It is very important that we make a good showing. Each of you may have one book to read, if you are good.
She goes on and tells us to mind our manners. Say yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. Don't grab and touch all the books. And if the workers ask whether we're happy here, we're to tell them we're very grateful to Miss Tan for finding us and to Mrs. Murphy for taking us into her home. I lose track of the rest. All I can think of is that we're going to have a chance at a book. And there's not much I like better than books, especially books I haven't read yet. With five of us, we can get five books. But when the workers unlock the yard gate and the line starts out, Mrs. Murphy stops Camellia and me and the babies.
Not you, she says. Since you haven't a place upstairs yet, you've no good spot to keep books. And we can't have the library's property being damaged.
We'll treat them real careful, I promise, I blurt out.
Normally, I'd never talk back to Mrs. Murphy, but I can't help it this time.
Please, could we get one book at least? And I can read it to my sisters and my brother. Queenie used to...
I button my lips before I can get myself in more trouble. We're not allowed to talk about our mamas and daddies here. Sighing, she hangs the rug beater on a nail in one of the porch posts.
Very well. But there is no need for the little ones to go, just you. And be quick.
It takes me a second to decide whether to leave the babies. Camellia grabs their arms and drags them toward her.
Go,
she pops her eyes at me.
Get us something good.
I give them one last look before scooting out the gate. It's all I can do not to run across the yard and bust through the magnolias. It smells like freedom out here. It smells good. I have to make myself stay in line and follow the rest of the kids around to the driveway real orderly. On the other side of the tree wall, there's a big black truck. Two more cars pull up. Miss Tan gets out of one, and a man with a camera gets out of the other. They shake hands, and the man takes a notepad and pen from his pocket. The big black truck says Shelby County Libraries on the side, and once we get closer, I can see that there's shelves coming right out of the back of it. And the shelves are full of books. The kids mill around them, and I have to put my hands behind my back and lace my fingers tight to keep from touching things while I wait my turn.
As you can observe for yourself, we provide the children with many stimulating opportunities,
Miss Tan says. And the man writes on his notepad like the words are going to get away if he doesn't catch them fast enough.
Some of our little ones have never enjoyed the luxury of books before coming to us. We provide wonderful books and toys in all of our homes.
I duck my head and fidget, and wish the crowd would thin out. If Miss Tan has other places like this, I don't know what they're like, but there's not a single book around Mrs. Murphy's, and all the toys are broke. Nobody even cares enough to fix them. Miss Tan's been here enough. She's got to know that.
Poor little waifs, she says to the man. We take them in when they are unwanted and unloved. We provide them with all that their parents cannot or will not give them. I bolt my eyes to the ground and make fists behind my back. It's a lie. I wish I could scream at the man. My mama and daddy want us. They love us. So did the father who came to see his little boy Lonnie and ended up broke down on the porch crying like a baby when they said Lonnie'd been adopted.
How long does the average child remain with the society? The man asks.
Oh, we have no average children here. Miss Tan pushes out a high little laugh. Only extraordinary ones. Some may remain longer than others, depending on the condition in which they come to us. Some are weak and small when they arrive, and so wan they cannot even run and play. We plump them up with 3 nourishing meals per day. Children require good food to grow properly. Plenty of fruits and vegetables and red meats always put the glow back in their little cheeks.
Not at Mrs. Murphy's house. At Mrs. Murphy's house, it's cornmeal mush, 1 little bowl morning and night. We're hungry all the time. Gabby's skin is pale as milk, and Lark and Fern's arms are so thin, you can see the muscles and the bones.
We monitor all of our boarding homes to be certain the children are properly fed and well-treated.
She acts like it's true for a fact. The man nods and writes and says,
mm-hmm,
like he's swallowing it whole, and it tastes real good. Go look in the backyard, I want to tell him. Go look in the kitchen. You'll see how it really is. I want to say it's so bad, but I know if I do, I won't get a book, but I will get the closet.
The children are so very grateful. We pull them from the gutters and...
Someone touches my arm, and I jump without meaning to. A lady in a blue dress looks down at me, her smile as bright as sunshine. And what do you like to read about? She asks. What sort of books? You've been so patiently waiting all this time. Yes, ma'am.
She leads me toward the bookshelves, and my eyes about pop out of my head.
I forget all about Miss Tan, and all I can think about are books. I've been to libraries in river towns before. But back then we had books of our own on the Arcadia, too. Now we haven't got anything. And when you haven't got a single book, the idea of putting your hands on one is like Christmas and a birthday rolled up together. I like any kind, I stammer out. Just looking at the shelves and seeing all those colors and words makes me smile real big. I feel happy for the first time since we came here.
Maybe a long book would be good since we just get one.
Smart girl, the woman winks at me. Are you a good reader?
Yes'm, real good. Back on.
I duck my head because I was about to say back on the Arcadia. Queenie had us reading all the time. There's a worker standing not 2 feet from me, and Miss Tan isn't far off either. If she heard that, I'd be out of here quick as spit.
All right, then, the book lady says. Let's see.
I like adventures. Adventure stories.
Adventures about what?
Queens and princesses and wild Indians. All kinds of things.
My mind fills with tales.
Maybe a western, then.
Or the river. Have you got a story about that?
A book about the river would be like going home again. It'd keep us till Brownie takes us back to the Arcadia. The woman claps her hands together.
Oh, yes, I do.
She lifts a finger into the air.
I have the perfect thing for you.
After a minute of looking, she hands me Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mr. Mark Twain. And I figure that one really was meant just for me. We've never had this book, but Briny had told us tales about Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn and Injun Joe. Mark Twain is one of Briny's favorites. He used to read those books when he was little.
You'd think him and Tom Sawyer were personal friends, even. The lady in the blue dress writes my new name, May Weathers, on the card. When she stamps the date in the book, I realize yesterday was Fern's birthday. She's 4 now. If we were on the Arcadia, Queenie would bake her a little cake, and we'd all give her presents we made by hand or found along the riverbank. Here at Mrs. Murphy's, the library book will have to do. When I get back to the yard, I'll tell Fern it's her birthday surprise, but she only gets to keep it a while. We'll make a mud cake and use flowers for frosting, and add twig candles with little leaves balanced on top, so Fern can play like she's blowing them out. The library lady gives me a hug before she sends me off, and it feels so good. I want to stay right there and hang on to her and smell the books, but I can't. I hold Huckleberry Finn real tight against my chest and start across the yard. Now we can leave this place behind any time we want. All we gotta do is join up with Huckleberry Finn. There's room on his raft for all 5 of us, I'll bet. Maybe we'll find the Arcadia out there somewhere. Even though I have to head back to Mrs. Murphy's house, it feels like a whole new place. Now, it's got a river in it. That very night before bed, we open Fern's birthday book and start on our adventures with Huck Finn. We've been traveling down water with him for almost a week when Mrs. Tan's shiny black car rolls up the driveway one afternoon. It's a sunny day, and hot as fry grease in the house, so her and Mrs. Murphy meet out on the porch to talk. I skitter around the fig tree and go up under the azaleas to listen.
Oh yes, the advertisements have already run in all the papers, Miss Tan is saying. I've had such a brilliant vision, I must admit. Fair-haired cherubs for a fair summer season. Yours for the asking. Perfect, isn't it? All the little blondes. Like a gathering of wood nymphs. Little elves and fairies, Mrs. Murphy agrees. It's almost as compelling as the Christmas baby program. Customers have been calling already. Once they see the children, they'll be vying against one another. Without a doubt. You'll have all of the children ready on Saturday morning, then. I will expect them well-dressed, dirndls and bows and all the niceties. Baths all around and scrub every one of them down to the nubbins. No grimy fingernails or dirt behind the ears. Be sure they know what is expected of them and what will happen to them if they humiliate me in public. Make an example of someone ahead of time, and be certain the other children see it. This party represents an important opportunity to grow our reputation for offering the finest. With the new advertisements, we'll have all of the best families in Tennessee and a dozen states beyond. They'll all be coming to see our children, and when they see them, they won't be able to help themselves. They'll have to have one. We'll make certain the children are properly prepared. Just let me look again at the list. They stop talking, papers rattle. The wind shifts and blows the azalea branches, and I see Miss Tan's head. Her short gray-brown hair catches the breeze and stands up straight when she bends close to Mrs. Murphy. I press against the wall and hold real still, afraid they'll hear me and look over the railing. The wind brings up the smell of something dead. I can't see it, but it probably ate the poison Mr. Riggs put out. Once the stink gets bad enough, he'll find the body and bury it someplace. Even May? Mrs. Murphy asks, and my ears perk up. She's hardly a cherub. Miss Tan gives a sharp little laugh. She'll be a help with the little ones. And she is quite a pretty thing to look at, as I recall. I suppose so. Mrs. Murphy doesn't sound happy. She isn't a troublemaker, to be sure. I'll have cars come for them at 1 o'clock on Saturday. Do not send them hungry or sleepy or needing to use the bathroom. Perky and bright and guaranteed to behave. That is my expectation. Yes, of course. What in heaven's name is that ghastly smell?
Rabbits. We've had a problem with them this summer.
I slip away before they can decide to go looking. Mr. Riggs is nowhere around, so it doesn't take me long to get past the fig tree and back to the hill. I don't tell Camellia about the viewing party, or that we're supposed to have an extra bath tomorrow. No sense letting her get started on a conniption fit ahead of time. I've got a bad feeling that I don't need to tell her about the extra bath anyhow. Camellia hasn't got blonde hair. Turns out I'm right. After breakfast on Saturday, I find out that Camellia's not on the list. Wherever we're going, she's not going with us.
I ain't sorry they don't want me if it means another bath. She pushes me away when I try to hug her goodbye.
Be good while we're gone, Camellia. Don't give anybody trouble. And stay away from the big boys. And don't go past the fig tree and...
I don't need looking after.
Camellia lifts her chin, but there's a little quiver in her bottom lip. She's afraid.
May! One of the workers barks. In line, now!
They've already got all the kids on the list gathered up.
We'll be back real quick, I whisper to Camellia. Don't be scared.
I ain't. But then she hugs me after all. The worker yells at me again, and I hurry into line. The next hour and a half is full of soap and scrubbing and hair brushing and bows and toothbrushes under our fingernails and ribbons and lacy new clothes. We try on shoes from a closet full until we find some that fit. By the time the workers take us to the cars out front, we don't even look like the same kids. There's the four of us, three other girls, a boy who's five, two babies, and Stevie, who's been told that if he wets his pants again, he'll get a whipping right then and there. We're not allowed to talk in the car. On the way over, the worker does the talking.
Girls, you will sit politely with your legs together like young ladies. Do not speak unless you are spoken to. You will be mannerly toward the attendees at Miss Tan's party. You will say only good things about your time at Mrs. Murphy's house. There will be toys and colors, cakes and cookies at the party today. You will...
I lose track of her voice as the car goes over a hill and comes within sight of the river. May fades like a speck of sun on the water, and Real comes out. She stretches toward the crack at the top of the window and pulls in air and catches all the familiar scents. For just a minute, she's home. Then the car turns a corner, and the river's gone again. Something heavy and sad settles over me. I lean my head against the seat, and the worker tells me to stop. I'm smashing my hair bow. In my lap, Gabian falls asleep, and I cuddle him close and let his hair tickle my chin. And I'm back home again anyway. These people can control everything about me, but they can't control where I go in my mind. But my visit to the Arcadia is too short. Pretty soon we pull up to a tall white house that's even bigger than Mrs. Murphy's.
Anyone who does not behave will be very sorry, the worker says,
and points a finger in our faces before letting us out of the car.
Be friendly with the guests at the party. Sit in their laps if they ask you to. Smile. Show them that you are good children.
We go inside and the house is filled with people. Other kids are there too, and babies. Everyone is dressed in pretty clothes, and we have cakes and cookies to eat. There are toys for the little kids, and before I know it, Fern and Gabian and even Lark wander away from me. A man takes Gabian outside to play with a blue ball. A dark-haired woman sits with Lark, and they color in a picture book together. Fern laughs and plays peekaboo with a pretty blonde-headed lady who sits off in a chair by herself looking tired and sad. Fern makes her laugh, and pretty soon, the lady is carrying my sister from toy to toy, like Fern can't walk for herself. They finally cuddle into a chair to read a book, and my heart squeezes
I think about Queenie and how she used to read to us. I want the woman to let go of Fern, to give her back. A man comes into the room and tickles Fern on the belly, and the woman smiles and says, "Oh, Taryn, she's perfect. Amelia would have been this age." She pats the chair arm. "Sit and read the book with us."
"You go ahead," he kisses her on the cheek. "I have some people to talk to."
Then he leaves the room. Fern and the woman are on their second book when the man comes back. They're so busy, they don't even notice that he sits down next to me on the sofa.
"Are you sisters?" he asks.
"Yes, sir," I answer just like I've been told to. "Ma'am and sir to everything." Leaning away, he takes a good look at me.
"You do favor one another."
"Yes, sir," I stare down at my hands. My heart speeds up, bumping around my chest like a wren caught in the shanty house.
"What does he want?"
The man lays a hand on my back. My shoulder blades fold around it. Little hairs tug at the bottom of my neck. Sweat drips under my scratchy dress.
"And how old," the man asks, "are you?"
Chapter 13. Avery. The cottage is quiet and filled with moonlight as I swing open the door. I fumble for the light switch and brace my cell phone against my shoulder as I wait for my Uncle Clifford to answer the question I've just asked. He's put me on hold while he orders food at a drive-thru window. I'm consumed by the strongest memory of arriving here after dark for a visit. Just my grandmother and me. The cottage was exactly like this. Moon spears fanning over the floor in the shape of palmetto fronds. The air smelling of salt water and sandy carpets and lemon oil and furniture that has lived long by the sea. I wiggle my fingers. I can almost feel her hand wrapped around mine. I must have been about 11 or 12, that awkward age when I'd quit holding her hand in public, but here in our magic place, it was okay. Standing in the entry now, I reach for that sense of comfort, but this visit is pungent with opposing tastes, bitter and sweet, familiar and strange. The tastes of life. Uncle Clifford comes back on the line. After a long walk along the beach and supper at the waterfront restaurant, I've decided that my uncle might be the only means of making progress in my quest, for now. Trent Turner ditched me by taking off in a Jeep with the guy in the uniform. I waited around in my car, but the Turner Real Estate office remained closed all afternoon. So far, this trip is looking like a bust.
"What was it that you needed, Avery? What about the Edisto house?"
Uncle Clifford wants to know. "So I'm just wondering if you and Dad came here much with Grandma Judy? When you were little, I mean." I'm keeping it casual, trying not to tip him off to anything. Uncle Clifford was a federal agent in his younger years. "Did Grandma Judy have friends she met here or people she came to see?"
"Well, let me think."
He ruminates for a while, then simply says,
"I don't guess we went there all that much, now that you mention it. We visited more when I was young. Once we were older, we liked Granny Stafford's place on Polly's Island better. The house was bigger, and the sailboat was there, and more often than not, we had cousins around to play with. Usually, Mama went to the Edisto cottage by herself. She liked to write there. You know, she dabbled in poetry a bit, and she did the society column for a while."
I'm momentarily dumbfounded. Grandma Judy wrote a society column? Otherwise known as the Weekly Gossip.
"Well, not under her own name, of course."
"Under what name?"
"If I told you that, I'd have to kill you."
"Uncle Clifford." While my dad is straight-laced, Uncle Clifford has always been wild and a bit of a tease. He's given Aunt Diana a full head of gray hair, which, as any good Southern lady would, she colors regularly.
Oh, let your grandmother's secret stay secret.
For a minute, I think there's a hidden message in that, but then I can tell he's just toying with me.
So you're down at the Myers cottage, huh?
Yes, I just decided to get away for a few days.
Well, drop a line in the water for me.
You know I don't fish. Yuck. Being saddled with girls, my poor father worked hard to form an avid angler from at least one of us. Even Uncle Clifford knows it was a lost cause.
Well, now see, that's one way you don't take after your grandmother. She loved to fish, especially down on Edisto. When your dad and I were little, she'd take us there to meet up with somebody who had a little John boat. We'd go up the river and spend half the day fishing. Don't remember who it was we went with. A friend, I guess. We had a little blonde-headed boy I liked to play with. Name started with a T. Tommy? Timmy? No. Trey or Travis, maybe.
Trent? Trent Turner? The current Trent Turner being Trent III, his father was a Trent too, and he's around my uncle's age.
Could have been. There's some reason you're asking. Anything wrong?
Suddenly, I realize I've gone one question too far and inadvertently unlocked the detective's office. No, no reason. Being on Edisto just started me thinking about things. I wish I'd come down here more with Grandma Judy. I wish I'd asked questions while she could still remember things, you know?
Well, that's one of the paradoxes of life. You can't have it all. You can have some of this and some of that, or all of this and none of that. We make the trade-offs we think are best at the time. You've accomplished a lot for a girl. I mean, a woman, just 30 years old.
Sometimes I wonder if my family doesn't see more in me than is really there. Thanks, Uncle Clifford.
That'll be $5 for the session.
The check's in the mail. After we hang up, I think through the conversation as I unpack the single sack of groceries I've picked up at the Bi-Low, which I remember as the Piggly Wiggly. Were there any clues in what Uncle Clifford said? Nothing jumps out at me. Nothing that leads anywhere. If the little boy in the John boat was named Trent, that tells me that my grandmother had some sort of personal connection to the elder Trent Turner, which I'd already guessed. But if they spent time out fishing together with the children, that also pokes holes in my blackmail theory. You don't go fishing with a blackmailer, and you certainly don't take your little boys. You also don't bring children with you if you're having an illicit affair, especially not children who are old enough to remember the outing. Maybe the elder Trent Turner was nothing more than a longtime friend. Maybe the envelope merely contains photos. Something totally innocent. But then, why the deathbed pledge between grandfather and grandson that the packets wouldn't be passed along to anyone other than their owners? I form theories as I carry my things to the bedroom, open my suitcase, and settle in. I throw darts at the theories, just the way I would if we were gathered in the war room at my old office. The darts hit their marks, and there's really nothing left. The day is catching up with me anyway. I'm ready for a shower and a good night's sleep. Maybe tomorrow I'll have a stroke of genius. Or maybe I'll catch up with Trent Turner III and wrestle the truth out of him. One possibility seems about as likely as the other. It's not until I'm letting the shower run and realizing that there seems to be no hot water in the cottage that I zero in on something Uncle Clifford said. My grandmother came here to write. Could any of her writings still be here? Could there be a clue in them? I'm back into my clothes in a flash. The cold shower really didn't sound so good anyway. Outside the cottage windows, the sea oats sway over the dunes, and the moon rises above the palmetto thicket. Waves thrum the shore as I rifle through drawers and search closets and blanket chests and wardrobe cabinets. I've almost surrendered to the obvious conclusion that there's nothing here to find, when I come up from checking beneath my grandmother's bed and realize the small piece of furniture beside it isn't a desk or a vanity table, but a typewriter stand. There's an old black typewriter hanging upside down underneath the center panel. Having grown up in family homes filled with vintage furniture, I more or less know how this thing works. It doesn't take me long to release the right combination of latches and swivel the hinges. The typewriter flips upright with an impressive wallop. I run a finger over the keys. I can almost hear my grandmother pecking away at them. Leaning close, I study the black rubber roller that pulls the page through. The keys have left tiny indentations behind. If this were a computer, perhaps I could pull something off the hard drive, but no words remain legible here. It's impossible to tell what's been written or when. "What do you know that I don't know?" I whisper to the machine as I rifle through the drawers. There's nothing in the stand but assorted pens and pencils, yellowed typing paper, a box of carbon sheets, and strips of correction film, chalky white on one side and slick on the other. The top sheet bears the impression of letters. Holding it to the light, I can easily make out the mistyped, then corrected words. Palmetto Boulevard, Edisto Island. My grandmother wrote letters here, apparently, but either accidentally or on purpose, she cleaned up her tracks. There are no partially used pieces of paper, and the carbon sheets are pristine. No ghosts of words left behind. Strange, because in her desk back home, there was always a folder filled with paper that could be reused for small projects, crafts, or children's drawings. I push a typewriter key, watch the hammer swing up and strike the roller, leaving behind only the faint, shimmery impression of a K. The ink on the ribbon is dry. The ribbon! The next thing I know, I'm bent over the black metal housing, wrestling it loose so I can get to the spools. It's surprisingly easy. Unfortunately, the ribbon is mostly unused. Only a few inches of it might contain the stamped-out impression of whatever was typed last. Unrolling it and holding it against the light, I squint to make out the imprinted letters. It's gibberish at first, but I've been around Grandma Judy long enough to know how a typewriter ribbon works. It rolls as the keys strike. The letters have to be in some sort of order. The first letters on the top line suddenly take on meaning. Judy, my grandmother's name spelled backward, right to left, the way it would have ended up after being typed. Another word rises from the muddle. Society, just after, or before, the period. Three more capitalized words precede it. Tennessee Children's Home. Grabbing a pencil and paper, I sort out the rest. Frustrated and wondering what else might have been in the records of the Tennessee Children's Home Society. Perhaps we will never know, Trent, as desperately as we might wish it. Yours sincerely, Judy. I stare at my own handwriting, trying to piece together the rest of the story. Children's homes are for orphans and babies given up for adoption. The young woman in May Crandall's photo was pregnant. Was she a relative of my grandmother's? One who found herself in trouble? Events come to life in my mind. A starry-eyed girl from a good family. A man of dubious reputation, a scandalous elopement, or worse yet, no marriage at all. An out-of-wedlock pregnancy. Perhaps her beau abandoned her, and she was forced to return to her family? Back in those days, girls were sent away to have their babies and quietly sign them over for adoption. Even now, women in my mother's social circles occasionally whisper about someone who went to stay with an aunt for a time. Perhaps that's what Trent Turner is keeping hidden. One thing is for certain. The last note written on this typewriter was to a Trent Turner, and though I can't tell how recent it is, there's little doubt that whatever's in the mysterious envelope will answer a lot of questions.